We know the tragic stories of people like Vincent van Gogh, who cut his ear off in a fit of rage. Beethoven, he was madly in love with this woman who he wanted to be with. She wanted to be with him. And he said to her, "If you love me, meet me at this certain place at this certain time." He was a romantic, and we'll be together forever. And she never showed up. What does he do? He creates the masterpiece, the Ninth Symphony. He continues to write all this very haunting, beautiful music that we enjoy today. The irony is that years later, he discovered from this woman that she did in fact try to make it. She wanted to meet him. She was in her carriage and on her way to be with him forever, this true love between this composer and this high society woman. And yet it was raining, there was a thunderstorm, and her carriage was stuck in the mud. This would haunt Beethoven. Now, Beethoven struggled like a lot of artists. And today, there's help. Back then, there just was not a lot of knowledge of psychology and how to help creative people. Psychology today says that there's a link between suffering and artistic genius. Now, everyone deals with suffering. You don't have to be an artist to have mental illness, but a lot of the genius in what we create comes from our trauma. Things we've experienced in our childhood, things we experience even now. There would not be all of this amazing, incredible pieces of art without understanding the suffering. You can't know goodness without knowing the badness. You can't know light without the darkness. It's like a moth. A moth is obsessed with the light, but they go in and out of the darkness. And there are people today who are donating their time to help so many creatives. One of the people that I started talking to when I came to Nashville was Chad Karger. I was going through a couple things after my heart transplant and moving to Nashville and trying to adjust in some things. And I went to Chad, who has spent 20 years counseling all kinds of creative people. Some of the biggest names in the music industry see Chad. And he also sees the people they love. It's not easy being married to a creative. So I'm excited to share with you this interview I did with Chad Karger, who is at Porter's Call. We'll talk more about what that is. I also have with me in this interview, helping to co-host and ask questions, Mark Mabry. He's a photographer turned artist who has a very popular series called Reflections of Christ. You can Google that, Mark Mabry, Reflections of Christ. He also has a daughter, Ava Mabry, who is a songwriter and musician. So a lot of the questions he asks, you'll sense that this is a father looking out for the future of his child. So without further ado, let's get into this interview with Chad Karger.
'Cause you took my scars, bruises and broken heart, numbed all the pain. Show me how to heal, and now I don't feel broken anymore.
Welcome to All Heart with Paul Cardall. Like you, his guests are all heart.
Just a reminder to subscribe to All Heart with me, Paul Cardall.
But the thing I loved with Chad is I could come in and be me, mm-hmm. and talk about God and talk about trauma, talk about creativity. And there's just something about your temperament and the spirit that you bring to the session. And here's what's crazy is Porter's Call is free. Mm-hmm. It's a ministry. People are not, I mean, I think they said throw $5 in the jar.
Yeah, we have a little basket downstairs, and the only thing we ask, it's not really a fee, but the $5 goes into a pool of money that we use in turn to help artists and needs that artists come to us with or we become aware of throughout the year. So we get to do that. That's how we use that money. We just pay it forward to the help and the health of other people. So,
and to put that in perspective, I try to get on your calendar and they're like, well, February's taken, March is taken.
I heard this conversation.
You know? Yeah. So it was like, Okay. So if you want to know why artists are like out there doing weird stuff, it's because Chad's not available.
Right. So donate to Porter's Call.
Yeah,
exactly.
We need more counselors.
We do. That's one of our objectives in the next year is to bring on. We have two counselors now, myself and Beth Barkas. And then Al Andrews is our founder and director, and he's kind of our rainmaker. He's the guy really connected to the industry and has a lot of relationships there and sort of keeps the pipeline, if you will, open. And so that's why we stay so busy, is because he's out there so much promoting what we do. And then Sydney Askew is our office manager, and she kind of keeps all the trains running on time. So.
And then how diverse is the roster of clients?
Yeah, it's really diverse. I was just talking. We have a gala every year. It's our main big fundraiser that we do. It's called Evening of Stories. And it's the biggest mechanism by which we generate revenue to fund the work we do so it can be free. And when you look at so it's not really a ticketed event. It's basically you are a sponsor, and there's so many tickets according to how big of a sponsor you are. And when you look at the roster of people who the organizations, the outlets, the streaming services, the management companies, the creative agencies, the recording labels, when you look at that roster of people who are contributing to make that evening work, that by far is probably one of the most diverse rosters of like music, creative, you know, musical community groups come together who make that happen. To me tells me like, you know, we have K-Love, the big nationwide Christian, you know, radio station, and YouTube Music sitting alongside each other, helping make that happen. To my point, and to your point, which is, yeah, we see every kind of artist playing every kind of music under the sun, and doing it for all different kinds of reasons. You know, as much as I am unapologetically a Christian, you know, I see people of every sort of stripe of spirituality or the lack thereof, and happy to do so. And that's part of what we really brand ourselves around, is like, this door is open to all people. You know, it did start off with the Christian music community. They're the ones who kind of came together with Al, our founder, 18 years ago, and said, we need something like this.
Yeah.
And they basically bought one of his days and said, hey, if we pay you to keep that day separate, and then we can send artists your way for free. And he said, okay. And they said, one caveat is that we want it to be any artist, not just Capital Christian or Provident artists, but all artists can come in here.
Yeah.
So really generous.
Yeah.
And that's pretty much where the whole thing started. And then it became 2 days and 3 days. And then it became, you know, the organization that it is, Porter's Call.
And obviously our audience right now is saying, who walks through the doors? And when you first started doing this, how many people did you recognize?
It's a good question. I mean, I would say probably half to two thirds of the people that I would see land on my schedule, if I didn't immediately recognize their name, if I did a quick Google search on them or read their info that they submitted to us, I was familiar with them instantaneously, either directly as a fan of and enjoyed their music, or like, I've never actually listened to any of their music, but I definitely know that person. So
I think it was after the third time I was still explaining who I was. He's like, who are you? What are you doing here?
I'm from Utah.
He's like, oh boy, we've got,
we got problems.
We got a 3-hour session here, right? For the next 2 days.
It's really fascinating. I mean, that's one of the, I enjoy meeting all the different people that I get to meet. And that's, of course, one of the big things about Porter's Call that we've worked really hard to do, is create a safe and completely confidential place. I mean, we don't talk about, you know, who we're meeting with outside of these four walls. And in this new office that we're in now, this home, it sits on a somewhat busy street here in downtown Franklin, people walking past it. And we don't hang a sign out front because we just don't want anybody sort of stopping and Googling, if you will, who it is that we are, and then sort of hanging out, watching, coming and going of people here. So we take all that really, really seriously. And I think over the 18 years that, you know, Al's kind of led the charge on this, that's one of the things that the industry and the artists all know, that that's what's happening. So,
you know, the past few years, I've done hundreds of podcast interviews, but I've never had the feeling I have right now, which is like just this monster question mark. I'm about to burst with questions.
Mm-hmm.
And I, part of me, like the man part of me says, there's these really deep questions. The kid part of me, the stupid questions are the ones that everybody's thinking right now, who walks through the doors, which obviously you respect. But what's the common, if there is a common problem or a root of all problems with musicians that break, and we're sitting here with, you know, Paul's obviously a whale, tons of streams, like I stream his stuff all the time, everyone does. If there is one, like, is there a root of all evil in this, in this industry?
I think one of the ways that we talk about what we do is prehab. Like that is like the preventative side of things. I mean, I feel like Porter's Call is at our best when an agent, when an artist, when a record label introduces us to a new artist and before they're started. And then we can, you know, we're going to host a new artist boot camp here in February.
So parenthetically, define that for us.
What's that? Prehab?
Well, not prehab, but an artist that's gonna make it, because that's so imperative to our conversation.
So one of the things that's really important to know about Porter's Call too is that we see all touring artists, signed or unsigned.
Okay, touring, so, signed or unsigned.
Yeah, so the actual, you know, the group of people that we visit with here is really small in comparison to what's out there. So like we see touring artists and we see their significant others, okay, their spouses or partners. And they don't have to be signed to a major label, although probably I would say 3/4 of our folks are signed to a major label. So, you know, we see, and again, that's part of the beauty of Porter's Call, is that we see everybody from the person who's just starting out to the person and what everybody would know if they walked downtown Franklin, and then everybody in between. And that, I think that's the beauty of it, is that they all pass each other in these hallways coming and going. And there's a sacredness to the space in that way.
You can feel it.
Yeah,
for sure.
And so that to me is, so that it's the whole idea of like the prehab, and I would say I'd be hard pressed to zero down on the issue that we address the most, but it's suffice to say that like when you're in a creative outlet as your vocation, you're doing something that is probably the thing that you love, you know, that you always dreamt about doing.
Right.
And the more you do it and the more success you have doing it, the more important that it becomes to other people and not just yourself. Those are some of the dynamics that you begin to deal with that are kind of the context in which every artist walks in here. They love what they do. They started doing it probably a long time ago.
Yeah.
Then other people got on board and loved what they do. And then they start making money. And then other people start making money. And then their minivan turns into a bandwagon, turns into a fleet of buses.
Right.
And all those things, that's all the context, you know, that then is kind of the environment, if you will, that does create certain struggles that are particular to, you know, this lifestyle, this vocation, this calling, if you will.
Yeah. So. There's one artist who just blows my mind that he's very open about this, so we can talk about him. And that's Zach Williams.
Mm-hmm.
Zach has won Grammys. He's performed with Dolly Parton. He's a rising star, if you don't know who he is. But he spent his whole life touring, mm-hmm. and was in a band and everything and all this. And he was just getting to the point where he was just not in a good place. Mm-hmm. He was addicted to a lot of drugs and alcohol, he openly admits, and marriage was falling apart. And so he decided to pack away his guitar and just quit. Mm. And so he quit. And then his wife came to him a couple of years later and said, "Hey, can you come speak to some women in prison?" He said, "I'm not going to go speak to any women in prison. What do they want from me?" He goes, "The last place I want to go is near the jail." So she goes, "Just come." And as they're in the car, he tells the story that she said, "Grab your guitar." Mm. And he started to play for these people, and all he did was just play some hymns. Mm. But in singing the hymns, he started to feel this redemption in his soul. Mm. And he got sober and he got clean. And he talks about how he had a ton of therapy. Mm-hmm. That's pretty common. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we've all seen Behind the Music where they crash and burn.
Yeah.
But what does it take, really, for artists, people who are married to artists, mm-hmm. what does it take to really have a breakthrough and to really... overcome.
Well, I mean, unfortunately, I think sometimes it does take moments like that, like Zach's, where he just was at the dead end. And that's the idea of prehab, is to get to someone, or them to get to us, before they actually are at that point, because there is a heavy toll that then has to be redeemed at that point. But what has to happen for a person to really begin to look at those things? I mean, perspective. If a young artist gets a glimpse of something, they hear a story, they're influenced by an older artist like Zach, who tells a story early in their career. I mean, that wherever it is, they can get a perspective, wherever they can they can triangulate their position. You know, like when you're backpacking, you try to find three fixed points to locate yourself off of a map. Before we had phones and GPS, and you just push a button, it tells you. You would sit and find the high points. You try to get a perspective.
Right.
So sometimes that perspective comes at the bottom when you've lost a lot, unfortunately. But sometimes that perspective can come before all that, you know. And that's usually when an artist walks through this door and sits down on this couch or in one of these chairs. They usually, if I ask them, "How did you find us and how did you hear about us?" It's some kind of story about a perspective. A friend told me, "Hey man, you need to go do this." Yeah. Or an agent told me, or a manager told me, or I had another person on the tour who'd been to see you guys, and they looked at me and said, "Hey, this might be time for you to do this." It's usually a story about perspective, you know, that led them in here. And again, that perspective that they bring in is either like, "I've lost everything, I'm about to lose everything," or they're like, "I'm just getting started, I have no idea what I'm getting myself into, and it just dawned on me," you know? So whatever that perspective is, it motivates them to come in and sit down and to begin that conversation.
If I'm a new artist and I ask you that question.
Which question?
The question that you just talked about. What am I getting myself
into?
Let's say I just started touring. I'm in a dirty van. I have someone very close to me, a guy, 18, has a bit of a following, and he's touring in the sense of he has a van. Mm-hmm. He lives in the van.
Yeah.
Down by the river.
Down by the river. But he's good and he's rocking, and you know, his Instagram's like, mm-hmm. and his streams are going up, and he's got everything. If I'm him sitting here, mm-hmm. and I say, "What am I getting myself into?" Assuming it pops. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm thinking about, when you say that, I'm just thinking about a conversation I had yesterday with an artist. And so I had two conversations. One a few days ago, where a new artist, newly signed publishing record deal, and so he gets this deal a year ago, and he goes to work writing songs. They're like, "Look, we're not going on tour. You're not going in the studio. We're not going to do any of that stuff. This year, what you're going to do, first year, is you're going to write songs." He had written songs in the past. That's how they found him. But this year, that you're now employed to write songs.
Challenging him.
He wrote, at the end of 2019, he wrote 135 songs. I mean, that to me sounds like just an amazing feat. And he wrote a lot of songs, and now he has to, this year, pick one of those songs to begin the EP and sort of building out now toward the stages. Then 2 days later, I had a guy sit here, and I kind of told him that story, and he was unfazed. I was shocked when I heard 135. This artist that was ahead of this other one, he was more advanced in his career. He's had a few big hits. He just looked at me and was just like, yeah. So to answer your question, what am I getting myself into? One of the things that I have observed in working with artists that may be a little bit counterintuitive to some other people who enjoy artist music and sort of observe artist life from afar is how hard they work. And I'm amazed at that. The like 135 songs in 1 year.
That's a lot of pouring your guts out.
That's a lot of pouring your guts out. It's a lot of like honing the craft. And so when this artist, then an older, wiser one said like, yeah, he's like, for me, the moment came when I switched gears and realized I'm going to have to work really, really hard at this. This is not just something I'm doing with my buddies in the garage anymore. If I really want to do this, I'm going to have to really go after it. And he told stories about becoming a better version of himself, a healthier version of himself, so he could pour himself into the craft. This is obviously a really healthy artist.
Yeah.
But the thing I would say to a young artist is, and sometimes I when I hear young artists talk and hear about why they're doing what they're doing and what they dream of, I'm not sure, I'm not always confident that they've really counted the cost, so to speak. It's going to get really, really difficult. Not in all the ways that some of us imagine, like, you know, 200 tour days a year or, you know, the paparazzi and all that. That's hard, not to take anything from that. But there is this little incremental daily 135 songs in a year written kind of hard and playing and learning. And, you know, that's just overwhelms me. And that hard work, when you don't know if it's paying off, if you, you know, you're sort of like, I wonder if this is going to work. You know, you live in suspension often as an artist, and the human psyche and the human soul, you know, the scripture says the hope deferred makes the heart sick. So when an artist lives in that heart sick kind of place, when you've got all these hopes piling up inside of you and you're just wondering, I mean, that's another place where you begin to see some of the maladaptive, we'll call it, or abnormal psyche or unhealthy life unfold, is in that suspended state. And sort of in our culture now, we have Instagram, we have streaming, and everybody's watching everybody else. So now you add to a suspended state, to a highly competitive, comparative state, you're just opening yourself up to all kinds of like, yeah, right, really sort of weird, funky places where the human soul doesn't really thrive.
Public analytics are, yeah.
Somebody asked, I was at the Music Biz conference with Dolly Parton there.
Mm-hmm.
And someone asked Dolly, are you happy to be here? She goes, well, I don't know. I dream myself into a corner.
Wow.
So I dream myself into a corner. And it was the best advice. And she's always got the best wit.
Her self-awareness, when you listen to her talk, it's astounding.
The podcast about Dolly is Dolly's America.
It's unbelievable.
Unbelievable. She says, dreamed myself into a corner. I think that that applies to anything,
mm-hmm,
really. And we talk about the musician. We talk about, you know, the musician's spouse who has to.
Yeah.
I mean, my wife came to Porter's Call because they were offering for spouses. And she says, you know, I got to figure him out. we're chickens without our heads on.
Yeah. It's...
And she found a women's group.
Mm-hmm.
And she comes home from these women's groups where it's just they're all talking about their spouses that are on tour, and I said, you know, who's there, and she said, I can't tell you.
That's right.
And she can't tell me. She goes, but
wow.
But what's beautiful about all of it is I'm around artists and what people see as celebrities. And it's been interesting in Nashville because you run into a lot of people who are on the television all the time or on the radio. People are people. Mm. And they are dealing with the exact same challenges a lot of us are. Yeah. You could throw in a lot of adulation, I think. Adulation, one of my favorite quotes is, adulation is poison. Mm. But what I'm really curious about, Chad, is, you know, you, when you started to be, you know, you started getting your education, when did you know that you wanted to, I guess, be a counselor to artists? Yeah, what is that journey like? I mean,
so my journey kind of goes back. I'll just put the stake down into my, when I was in college. I mean, I could probably go back further than that, but definitely in college. And I was studying psychology and philosophy and religion and that kind of stuff. So first of all, you know, I was going to have to do more schoolwork if I was ever going to do anything with any of those subject matters, you know. But what I really wanted to do was I wanted to kind of bring all those things together, you know, and I was going to have to sort of do probably something. I realized, you know, right before I left college, I was going to have to do something that I just felt like I was probably going to have to kind of sort of plow and create my own path, you know. And so what for me was the real kind of the passion, the, it's like the little spark that I've just nurtured all these years, as it were, this flame that I carry inside of me, that's sort of my guiding light, is this, what I feel like is this God-given passion or desire to really be with people in all those little places of their life, that to walk with them through those places, you know, and to help them face challenges, to find perspective, to make changes, you know. I just began to have a real desire for that, a priestly kind of desire. I mean, I've worked in the church, you know, I've been in pastoral work before, but I sought a degree in counseling because I felt like that was the tool that I needed. I need to learn that craft in the art of listening and conversation, to be able to get to those spaces with people, you know, to drop below the surface. And, you know, you get the degree, and I have a master's in counseling, as does everybody here, myself and Beth and Al. But for me, I don't think I had like a specific population of people that I just was like, I wanted to be available, you know, and I'm just going to kind of sort of follow this light, you know, and see where it leads me. And it led me initially into creating, this is not Porter's Call, but another organization, that worked primarily with people in leadership. So we worked with community leaders, pastors, business leaders, really influencers on that end of the sort of community spectrum. So we set up a shop, an organization called Better Days that worked specifically with those kind of people. So I guess there was an early sort of uptick in me that said, like, I want to work with people who are influencing other people. I feel like there was a real powerful leverage point there. If you help bring healing to people who are offering healing to other people,
right,
then if they're healthy, the 250 people that they're influencing in their life are going to be healthy. And so that really motivated me, you know? And so the way I got connected to Porter's Cause is sort of serendipitous, you know, route, which is when I was studying my graduate school work, I met Al Andrews, who was in the faculty at that school.
Wow. Wow.
And he was one of my instructors. He was one of my teachers. And we just became friends. That transcended my time there at school. I then went back to Texas. That school was in Colorado. I went back to Texas and began doing the work that I just described, and did it for over 20 years. And then when Al began to get to a point here at Porter's Call where he wanted to not be in the counseling end of things as much, but be more just on the development end of things, he called. And probably when I knew that when Al started Porter's Call, we were friends and I was aware of it, and I would come up and see him and come to the Evening Stories Gala occasionally. I mean, of course I wondered, like, I wonder if I could do that. You know, I wonder, would that ever be an opportunity? And we talked for many years about the possibility of doing it, and the timing just was never right, either on this end or on my end. But then all of a sudden, everything just sort of fell into place and it became right for everybody. And that's when I got the invitation to come join the work. And so, you know, that's actually when it all kind of crystallized. But so I guess my point being, it's like sort of to your point earlier, which is I was deep diving inside of sort of the soul of people who were leaders, influencers, and other sectors, you know, of society, to then come up out of that and then deep dive into this sort of the creative person's influencer, you know, there's strong similarities, easy transitions. And then there's some mechanisms of the industry and the work and the life and that I had to learn and I'm still learning. But that's it, you know, kind of how I ended up here. And, I love music, and the hard part of me is not always like getting excited about the person I'm about to meet. If I meet with some guy that no one's ever heard of, but he's an amazing drummer and he's a part of this band and he's played drums for a long time, I kind of geek out on I love the rhythm section in a band. That's just sort of my own personal thing, the bass and the drum. So sometimes I'll kind of chase a rabbit, with a client about, okay, so tell me now, let me play you this part of a song. Tell me about, you know, and
awesome.
You know, and that to me is just really enjoying, but it usually comes back around to where there's some sort of application or context of the matter of the soul or the mind that we're talking about in his drum kit and his, you know, keeping the rhythm of a band going his life and who he is as a person. And that's what really excites me, is all that kind of stuff. So I just love music.
I wonder how you prepare. How do you prepare yourself mentally? Because you have bad days.
Oh, yeah.
So how do you prepare mentally to help encourage?
Yeah, yeah.
How do you, Chad, in the morning, I got to see this person today. How do you prepare?
That's a good question. I mean, I'm so thankful for, you know, good health and a sound mind and all those kinds of things that obviously are a big part of being able to do what I do. But I do live in a pretty predictable pattern of behavior. I'm a creature of habit, and I have done that for a really long time so as to be the best version of myself. I sort of found over the years, I've found what works and what helps me to be that way, and I just try to stay committed to that. And so some of the things for me that are really important is to wake early, to have a lot of time in the morning to kind of prepare myself through meditation and prayer and reading. And I exercise, you know, 6 days a week. And a lot of times when I come in here, I usually look at my list of people that I'm seeing that day. And if they're a new person, I will do a little research on them and try to figure out what's going on. I try not to do too much of that, though, because that's part of the joy of just sitting down with someone the first time and genuinely asking, not rhetorically, but genuinely, like, tell me about where you're at and what you're doing. So I try not to do too much of that. And there, you know, when you start meeting with people, you realize, you look at the schedule and you realize that name, that situation's heavy. That's tomorrow afternoon. And I definitely start thinking about that. And so, you know, I try to be in my best place and I try to be in my best place for everyone, but I do anticipate problematic situations, you know, stressful situations. I care deeply about people. Obviously, I wouldn't do what I do if I didn't. But I think also, I'm thankful for the ability to hold things at their right place in reference to my life, to be able to hold them in a healthy way so that I can go home and be a husband, a father, a friend, a healthy person. So sometimes things can haunt me, and they do. I carry them.
Yeah.
But I am thankful that for the most part, I do find a way to sort of draw the line, walk outside of that situation for a little while so that then I can again re-enter, you know, the conversation again when I see them the next week or the next time. And And I'm always on the prowl. Like if I'm reading, listening, hearing, all of that's always coming to bear, either directly or indirectly with the person I'm talking to. I'll sometimes pull out a book I'm reading and read. So my own self-care often translates into being able to care for that person. And so, you know, there's just some things that like that, being located in a community of people who know me.
Yeah.
My parents know me. My wife knows me. My kids know me. They all have access to me. I'm trying to be as real and transparent with them as I can be, so that being real and transparent here is not some sort of charade or new something. It's just seamless in who I am, you know?
I know, like, my experience at Porter's Call has dramatically changed me.
Mm. How?
Because I thought I was open-minded about a lot of things. I came to Nashville and fell deeper in love with God because of the consistency in the faith. Mainly it's Christianity here, but it's helped me develop a better understanding of who I am and my relationship to God. And so it's broken down a lot of walls to where I see everybody as a family member of God. There's nobody outside of that. So, you know, traditions and that we pass down are good and can haunt us. So, you know, Chad's been able to help me work.
Well, I think one of the things that we do is when you come into a counseling session, the very nature of it slows everything down.
Yeah.
And so you know, you're right. Some people like you like to talk a lot. And so slowing them down is interrupting them and saying, hey, hang on a second, go back 10 minutes ago what you said.
I don't cut people off.
Well, I cut people off. And then slowing down for some people is calling them out of their silence and realizing that, like, hey, I'm not going anywhere. We're going to sit here and we're going to have this conversation 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 times, you know, whatever it is that you come here. And so I think when you do that for a person, when you slow things down like that, you either are going to be more committed to the process and grow more thoughtful and conscientious, or you're going to have to double down and commit to running faster and harder and leave the process altogether.
Yeah.
It's decisive. That silence, that sort of pace, it's decisive in that way. And, you know, when you embrace it and you go with it, like meditation and those kinds of practices and exercises, it really does do an amazing job at helping us to be more human, you know, to be more humane. We tune in better. We watch more, we're more aware, you know, self-aware and others aware. And so that, I feel like that's, some people will come in with an issue, a very specific issue like trauma or events or a particular frustration and challenge in a marriage or a relationship or whatever. And that's, you go to work right there, you know. But some people come in and they're like, I'm not exactly sure what I need. And so usually what I end up doing is just going back and saying, then we're going to start telling your story. So I will work with a person through kind of increments of 5 to 10 years of their life and just start having them retell and get more and better acquainted with their story as a person up to their present moment. That sort of slow down like that and working out that timeline and family history, like just creates a certain level of awareness that is directly related to, like, oh, that's where I came from. I forgot about that. And that person was really instrumental. So that's real direct, you know, proportion to that work. But the indirect nature of that slowdown is like you just become a better listener. You become more present. You become, you know, more creative. You become comfortable in your own skin, you know. And I think that's that speed, just slowing things down. That's what, you know, the craft, the health of counseling in and of itself.
And I never realized that in doing this, what I've been doing, you do a timeline of your entire life.
Mm-hmm.
You list everything on there that may have affected you, starting with birth. You're not even thinking birth, but coming into this world was
arrive on a scene. There's a context that's already unfolding that you arrive in.
Yeah, so you have to learn to have compassion for you, but you have such compassion for your mother. Then you start listing all of these things. And, you know, in my world, 157 medical procedures. Yeah. And so it's like you have to address each one of those. But then what's fascinating as you go along the process is you start to see you. Because you're not always you. You're not always in self. We tend to be, we disassociate.
Mm-hmm.
And musicians that are good at what they do are constantly told how great they are. So when they're not on tour, the people who really know them can call them on their crap. And it throws them off in that transition of coming home because it's not, they're not being worshiped and adored. And so one of the tricks for musicians is important to learn.
Yeah.
Adulation is poison.
No, it's, I tell artists all the country schedule, we'll just take that for example, the country touring schedule for the most part is usually leave town Wednesday or Thursday and they usually get back Sunday night, Monday morning. So that's a pretty typical schedule.
Yeah.
And I tell artists all the time, like that transition that when you're home Monday, Tuesday, part of Wednesday before the bus call, you know, I tell them when you walk off the stage of the last gig for that run, imagine yourself walking into your home right there. So don't wait until like, if you go party that night, if you go, if you don't, if you're not mindful, that then what's going to happen is you're not going to be as prepared Monday morning when you actually do arrive home. You're not going to be ready to be a mom or a dad or a husband or a wife until late Tuesday afternoon. You're leaving town Wednesday.
Hey, you can't go home tired.
No. So you have to like, you have to make that transition that night, say, and really begin to understand what it is that you're getting involved in, what's waiting on you when you get home. And, you know, carve out that sort of mental, spiritual, soul transition from this really sort of contrived world that you've been in with lights, cameras, action, music, you know, that you're totally in control of. And this is an interesting point, to a world that you're going home to where you feel totally out of control.
You feel isolated.
You feel isolated. You feel unseen, unheard, unuseful, you know. And so that transition, that sacred space, again, from last gig to arriving at your doorstep, that's a really, it's a sacred pilgrimage every single week for an artist.
And it sounds easy to just go, okay, well, I'm going to get inside my wife's head and try to imagine what she's been going through.
Yeah.
But get into the mind of your child.
Yeah.
They haven't seen their dad. They haven't seen their mom. You know,
the downshift that you have to do to be able to like sort of make that transition is significant. And to the point of just what we do here is we're trying to help. We're both calling it out and saying, hey, that's an important space, isn't it? And then also giving them tools. How are you going to do this? Like what's so, you know, meditation, maybe, you know, that's a sober time for you or you're not drinking. Maybe you need to moderate the intake the days and nights before that, but you're beginning that whole transition right there. So that just comes from self-awareness. That comes from like saying like, if I want to be that person who's engaged and available and healthy when I get home, I'm going to have to actually do some little things incrementally that gets me into that kind of modality, you know?
Yeah.
Do you, that's fascinating. And a question that keeps coming back is, do you hear people's music change as they change?
Yeah, it's that's an interesting situation and an idea. Like, I do think that there are some artists who their craft, the way they use their craft, it's a real replica of themselves. You know, they're singer-songwriters, they may be country or Christian or you know, rock, and they just really use the pen and the song and the lyric to really replicate who they are and their experience in the world. I do think that there are some artists who are not so much doing that all the time, but they're capturing sort of the human, you know, story, not necessarily their own story. Mm-hmm. And so you have projections of pain, or you have projections of nonsense in some cases, where it's like, yeah, to when they come and sit down here, this is why I don't do a lot of background research on the music. If I don't know the artist, I don't go back and listen to their catalog or listen to their songs, because that artist may not be singing about their story. And if I go listen to 3 or 4, 5, 6 songs before they get here, and I'm thinking like, oh, this is who they are, that may not actually be the case. That's just who I am as an artist.
Yeah.
That's my persona. That's what I'm projecting. That's my brand, you know? And so different people approach that craft in different ways and use their pen and their melody and their band and their songs and their stage to project different things. And it all has value. I think it all has merit creatively and artistically, and obviously has high entertainment value, but it's not necessarily always autobiographical in a direct sense. It's always telling of something.
Right.
And it's always indicating and signaling something, but it may not necessarily be the thing itself that they're singing about. That's a part of their experience. Does that make sense?
Yeah. My office, I have a unique situation because my office is a corner surrounded by all these writing rooms.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm hearing young writers, mature writers, experienced writers come in and write their songs. And even when I write with an artist as a way of mentoring, they always automatically go to the bar and go to the breakup.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, this sounds like a song that's on repeat that you keep pouring gasoline on. And ironically, a friend, Eric Etheridge, just wrote a song called Gasoline. Why do we keep pouring gasoline on everything? So I'll bring an artist in, and writing becomes therapy.
Mm. Oh, definitely.
I had a 29-year-old songwriter in my room with another writer, and this writer wanted to write about the problems with constantly breaking up.
Mm.
You know, and I said, "Well, have we talked about why we keep breaking up?"
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, so it's trying to get them to think differently than just, you know, this will be a good song to sell a truck.
Yeah.
Or this will be a good song. You know, it's like, what are we saying?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if you mention, hey, we just want to write really good songs.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody in the other room goes, yeah, me too. Me
too. Exactly.
Me too. Me too.
All the other people with publishing deals are saying the same thing.
And there is a lot of people mm-hmm. signed to publishing deals.
Yeah.
But it's the guys that write the 130 songs a year
mm-hmm.
where you start to find your voice and you start to become successful, and then you come to Porter's Call.
Well, the point in that story was is that he was faced with the daunting task of actually picking 3 or 4. And so, see, right here, this is a great example of what your question was, is like what I said to him is I said, well, why did you get into this to begin with? Now you have 135 songs you've written in 2019, and you have to pick, you know, half a dozen to really start hammering out in the studio and taking on the road and, you know, whatever. And that question didn't turn just artistically, you know, but more personally. You need to step back now and start going through this catalog of music and saying which one of these songs really represents who I am as a person and what I want to say to the world. You know, where's my voice in this?
Yeah.
That if that I can appreciate and hear that if I don't bring it to the surface, is not going to ever be heard in the universe. And that kind of like, wow, okay, now that's exciting. There's a lot of pressure there on the one hand, but you know, you wrote 135 songs, so you've got something in there.
Yes.
And so going and finding that voice, you know, is a journey. But see, paralleling my conversation with a guy like that is this whole entire personal story that's unfolding between he and I, about his family, about his mom, about his sisters, about where he comes from, about his girlfriend, you know, the things that he's struggled with, the places he's been in. You know, one of the things that we do on the timeline when we do that here is we talk about innocence, moments of innocence in your life. So clearly there, when you map out a timeline, you can take a green marker and circle the moments that are just pure sort of childlike innocence, literally in your childhood or just childlike. there's tragedy. Every timeline has tragedy. Everybody's story has tragedy in some scale.
Yeah.
And you circle that. And then the part probably that's most nuanced, most people haven't thought about it, we talk about here is contending. Where do you go once you face the reality of life and the struggle? How do you begin to contend for beauty,
yeah,
for place, for yourself, for others, right? Mm. And that place there, that inflection point where you begin to contend, becomes a place where either it's usually a mixture of things, really honorable things begin to surface, and maybe some less honorable things. That's maybe the place where you're contending through an addiction, you're contending through codependency, you know, you're contending through compulsive and habitual behavior.
It's all the self-soothing.
It's that, that's trauma. So how are you contending? Where right. are you contending?
Right.
It's that moment where a little boy had his heart broken and he says, well, I'll never let my heart out again. You know,
you wouldn't ask that to me though. I've already done that. I've done that. They gave me a good heart.
Yeah.
As we conclude, mm-hmm. One last question.
Okay.
So Mark and I, we both have very talented daughters who sing. Mm. Mark's daughter is going to be doing her first gig today.
Oh, wow. That's awesome.
Yeah. At the Moxie.
Oh, wow. That's really cool, man. Enjoy that.
And she's
excited.
She's 14?
13.
13. Wow. 13. Debut at the Moxie.
Man, strong.
And great thing is Mark plays guitar, and so he's going to be playing with her.
He can double as bodyguard, guitarist,
exactly.
Manager.
She goes potty. I'm walking with her.
Yeah, pretty much. And what, you know, there's obviously, there's a lot of parents with future celebrities.
Mm, interesting.
And
no, I am sitting on the proverbial couch right now.
Yeah, you are, Mark. You've ended up there.
And these parents have a lot of conversations with each other about what is best and what is right for that child. And what's been great is you see unified support for their daughter. Mark's married to a pretty amazing person. What's your advice to parents and how to deal with the creative child that wants to be famous?
Well, I am just going to lean back on the couch now.
Yeah. Oh, man. I'm telling you, that's actually very, that's a very specific thing that we talk a lot about here. And, you know, one of the things I'll just say is that sooner is not better. And I would say slow is always better on this front, and to allow the child to be a child, you know, and fame and celebrity and industry will prematurely age any person. It speeds up the aging process. And usually it's not until some point down the road, if it's not checked early, that that health has to be recaptured and regained. It's always going to, it will have to be corrected. So going slower is better. Allowing that person to be a child, even though they're sort of living into adult spaces, you know, with their creative instincts and impulses.
Yeah.
On Friday night, she sings at the Moxie and knocks it out of the park, and all the adults love what she does. But Saturday morning, she may be curled up in front of the TV watching cartoons. Like, that's the kind of space that just has to be allowed for. And I think that that's just critical, is that kind of idea that that a child is allowed to be a child, even as they begin to develop as an artist. Of course, encouraging a child to be an artist is wonderful. It's what every, I have three really creative kids and encourage them in all the ways that they do their thing. I think too, to have, you know, I would never, honestly, when I ask an artist, whether they're young or old, why do you do what you do? If celebrity or fame is in the equation, it's just like, that's not a good reason. Honestly, it's just not good enough. And you're gonna have to, we're gonna have to sit longer and talk further and deeper about why it is you do what you do, because fame is not one of the noble ends to this profession. Fame is, for all intents and purposes, the most inhumane and anti-human sort of result.
It's an illusion.
It's an illusion.
It's a magic trick.
It is. It's so to me, like, that's never the end point. It has to be something deeper and wider and better. You may have gotten in when you're 12 or 13 because you think, well, that'd be really cool to be like Taylor Swift, you know. But the fact of the matter is that some point down the road, Taylor realized, you know, and anybody else in her orbit, that this is no place for a human being to live. And you begin to fight against that and manage that and mitigate that all along the way. So all that being said, coming back to a child, it's like, sure, encourage, train, teach them how to work hard at their craft. You know, like my friend who said, you're going to have to write a lot of songs and practice your guitar and enjoy the journey, you know, and not to chase fame. Cause it's like chasing the, it's like I tell my clients, we have a couple of cats at home, and when I get that little flashlight out and I start casting that light on the wall, watching that cat chase that stupid light on that wall is one of the most ridiculous and hilarious things. And you just think, this cat is so stupid. They're never going to get this. And even if they do, what is it that they've got?
And you're playing devil.
Yeah, playing the devil there. And that's really what fame becomes. It becomes the brightest object in the room for an artist. And it's, in the end, their demise. So I would never encourage that part of it, but definitely encourage the creative process, because it's a wonderful way to be a human being, is to create something from nothing and speak that into the world.
Yeah, I mean, we are co-creators in a way with God. I mean,
absolutely,
we're helping write the story.
Yeah, I mean, I think of the artist as being someone in that sense, you know, the Latin phrase ex nihilo, which is from nothing. And in the Christian and Hebrew text, you know, God is creating from chaos, from nothing, essentially. I think of an artist creating, taking the chaos, the sort of primordial stuff inside their soul, and shaping it into something, lyric, sound, melody, beat, timing,
yeah,
that comes into being in the world. And that in itself is redemptive for them. It's redemptive in the world. Even if the song is hard, there's some redemptive quality in the creation itself, calling it out and putting it in that, you know? And so helping at Porter's Call, we're helping people clear the path to be able to do that kind of creative work, you know? So
I want everybody to Google Porter's Call. Mm. You'll find an image of a porter holding a light, and that's what this place is. That's what Chad is. He's holding that light for mm-hmm. musicians to come and know there's a very safe environment where they don't feel the paparazzi.
No,
they don't feel any of that. Yeah, they can totally just reveal
mm-hmm.
in sacred privacy.
Yeah,
really, because there's a powerful spirit here of healing.
Thanks, Paul.
They want that healing. And my heart, my borrowed heart, continues to heal because of my association with Porter's Call and people who you've guided me to. And we're pretty sure Mark's daughter will not need Porter's Call because she's a star, a perfect angel.
Tell you what, though, on that point, man, I had question marks 30 minutes ago.
Yeah.
But what you just said about fame being inhumane, like, it's the only thing I can think about right now.
Mm.
You honestly just knocked my socks off in the last 3 minutes. So
I think it's like, you know, if an artist can walk off a stage and almost immediately, as it were, walk back into a real or spiritual or just psychological community where people know their name and they can just be themselves, you know?
Yeah.
And that's what helps preserve, you know, and really energize the creative instincts that really are going to be the gift, you know? And you know, I'd love for artists to like be really successful as a result of the work that we do, but our aim is not for them to chart top, you know, or to have, you know, a million streams. Our our goal is to help them be the best and healthiest version of themselves and take that wherever it goes with them.
Scooter Braun, who is one of the most successful managers, he bought Big Machine.
Yeah.
Manages Justin Bieber. Yesterday on Instagram, he posted, "Go out and have a good day. None of this is real."
One of my favorite phrases is go outside. And for me, that not only means like go stay on the front porch or go for a run or a bike ride, but leave the confines of the contrived spaces that cramp us and that make us small as humans, and experience that locating place, like that place where you get you're put into your place in a good way, in that bigger landscape and that bigger context, you know. And so I really appreciate that sentiment. Exactly.
So. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome, guys. Thanks for asking me.
Porter's Call, the website.
Porter'sCall.com. How to get in touch with us, who we are, how we function.
And donation.
Yeah, that's...
Donate if you can, if you love your artists.
Yeah, that's what we want, is for the artists who can to give back in return. But we really ask the industry leaders, the people who make money on artists and off of artists, say, hey, look, this is your most precious commodity. So if you make an investment in Porter's Call, you're making an investment in their health.
Which is right, because the artists actually are kind of at the bottom of the totem pole in making money off music. I learned that from the reverse mode of coming from owning a record label, owning all my publishing, to the acquisition, to where now I'm like, oh, okay, I see how it works. I need help, Chad. Thank you so much.
Thank you, guys. Thanks, Paul. Thanks, Mark. Yeah, thank you.
'Cause you took my scars, bruises, and broken heart, numbed all the pain. Show me how to heal, and now I don't feel broken anymore.
Number one Billboard pianist Paul Cardall.
Do you believe in miracles and second chances? Over a decade ago, I was raised from the dead.
Read Paul's story, The Broken Miracle, by J.D. Netto.
Visit thebrokenmiracle.com.